your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org.
Hello, I'm Matt Brooks. You are listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, the best radio station you'll ever hear.
For the City. Living for the City is a program focusing on telling stories, our histories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you have lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the real estate industry and the very powerful lobbyists. We look at housing, land, air, and water use, including sunlight, and we do so truthfully, accurately, and without any conflicts of interest. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the program host and executive producer, and the senior producer is Jillian Jonas. Before I go further and introduce my first guest, I want to familiarize you to the concept of Sankofa. Sankofa is a word in the Akan, Twi, and Fante languages of Ghana, Africa, that translates to retrieve, literally go back and get. And just like the Sankofa bird that is looking back over its shoulder to see where it has come from, we look back in history to see where we've come from, to better understand how we come to exist in this current moment and help us chart a course for the future. And on this day in peace and social justice history, August 16, 1953, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the constitutional monarch of Iran, dismissed the elected Prime Minister, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, without the approval of the Parliament. In appointing General Fazlollah Zahedi in his place, the Shah was following the coup plan, codenamed TP Ajax, developed by the CIA under the direction of Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of President Theodore, and Great Britain's Intelligence Service, MI6. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, August 16th, 1963, Buddhists staged protests across South Vietnam against the government of President Ngo Dinh Diem, a Catholic who removed Buddhists from important government positions and replaced them with Catholics. Buddhist monks protested Diem's intolerance of other religions and the methods he used to silence them. Several Buddhist monks immolated themselves in protests of the war being waged against insurgents in the South and against North Vietnam. And again, I'd like to welcome you to Living for the City over WBAI 99.5 FM. WBAI is a commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station. That's right, listener-sponsored. in the center of the FM dial in New York City, listener sponsored, commercially free since 1960. Do what you can to support the continuing, the ongoing access to information, these kinds of stories, the stories that you just heard on the previous program, Ecologic, with Ken Gale, Donna Stein, and Sally Geller. Democracy Now! Earlier, what's going on before that? Make a contribution, do what you can to support WBAI. Well, our first guest is the executive director of one of New York City's most respected preservation organizations. This group is especially accomplished given its tiny staff of three, a budget under $500,000, and no fewer than 10 historic districts within its purview. So speaking of what's going on, on the Upper West Side, Sean Corsandi, Executive Director of Landmark West. Welcome to Living for the City, Sean. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Sean, can you hear me okay?
I can now, yes.
Okay, great. Sounds good. What's going on on the Upper West Side? We're going to be talking in this conversation, all things Upper West Side. I wonder if we could start talking about the status of Presbyterian Church, and then, you know, you can take us in several other directions because there's so much to talk about. There are 10, did I say that right? 10 historic districts. So let's start with the Presbyterian Church.
Sure. It's been a hot topic, and it's made national headlines, largely because there has been some celebrity attention brought to it. But the church itself is a celebrity in its own right. This building was designated by the Landmarks Commission in 2010, and it is deemed to be among the finest examples of Romanesque Revival-style religious buildings in the entire city. Mm. It's on a prominent corner. It's on 86th and Amsterdam, and it has begun on that site 140 years ago. The sanctuary itself is 134 years old, and this is a congregation that was once deemed the millionaire's gateway to heaven. And its history is important not just for its architecture, not just for who went there as congregants, but also for its contributions to society in general. Joe Papp, who everyone's familiar with, he started the Shakespeare Festival, which became Shakespeare in the Park, got his start on the balcony here. God's Love We Deliver, which delivers meals to people afflicted with AIDS and HIV, got its start here. The first same-sex marriage was performed here. So there's a lot of significant firsts for the residents of New York City and the state that happened in this building itself. Mm. So what's the issue at the moment? This is an individual landmark. We have about 60 on the Upper West Side, and one would think that it's protected in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. But there's a clause within the landmarks law that allows an owner of a landmark, a steward, to claim hardship. This is a very rarely used provision, and it's being used in this case in a new way that we haven't seen before. And this is what's raising alarms and getting a lot of other people in the community motivated.
Mm-hmm. Who is the steward today?
The steward would be the congregants. So it's an interesting case. In the presbytery, there's a model wherein the congregation itself owns the building. And there's a session or a larger group, an umbrella, that covers the New York Presbytery. And what the congregants have done in this case, they said that the building is too much to maintain, and they've handed it over to the umbrella group. And that umbrella group has made a various series of agreements with different people. One of them is with Alchemy, which is a development company. It's the same company that restored the Woolworth Building, once the world's tallest building, that everybody knows and loves, by Cass Gilbert. And they came in and analyzed the feasibility of reuse for this building, which is a curious term because the building has been in constant use. There's a group called the Center at West Park there right now, which provides affordable space for rehearsals and for different acting troupes.
Can you speak to what these proposals might be for different uses? I understand some of these things may be in litigation at the moment, and you're not at liberty to talk about them. But To the degree that you are, can you talk about what
sure,
some of these
absolutely.
Proposals might be? Okay.
So there are two different lawsuits. One is with a separate entity, the current occupant. It's a nonprofit, the Center at West Park, which I mentioned. And they are suing over a lease renewal because they had a lease agreement with the congregation. And as I mentioned, the congregation handed over responsibility. So that agreement allows them a five-year extension. On the flip side is the agreement between Alchemy Development and the New York Presbytery. And they have a right of first refusal, essentially, to buy the church, it's the landmark itself, and reuse. But under the hardship provision, they've done cost analysis. So they've looked at what would it cost to repair this building fully, dressed to the nines. And as you walk around the city, we have lots of great landmarks. They're not always necessarily in the best of condition. Not every facade is cleaned regularly. Maybe some windows have peeling paint, etc. They came up with a proposal that would restore every aspect of this building inside and out, bring it up to modern code. And it's an inflated number, and they're saying that there is not the money to reap from the building if they do all these improvements. So they're saying it's a losing battle. So they're proving from an economic standpoint, or they're trying to prove that this is not feasible. The question is, can it remain a church? Of course it can. There's another congregation that uses it every Sunday. If you pass by, the music is filling the street. They leave the doors open, and they let everyone in. So it does have an active, continual use. And the question becomes, okay, is the building viable? They're claiming the scaffolding has been up for 20 years. Well, that's their fault. That's their responsibility. They should have made repairs. And so this becomes a blame game of you never should have the congregation complaining to that the Landmarks Commission never should have designated it, and then them also saying that the building is so detrimental. But if they're stewards of the building, and it was about to fall as they pretend it would be, the DOB would have stepped in, the Landmarks Commission would have stepped in. There's a whole series of checks and balances to prevent structures from falling in the street. So there's two vying opinions right now. There's the proposals from the developer who says this is too expensive and requires too much work, and then there are analyses done by the center at West Park, which shows it's within reach, it can be phased work, and this building is more than salvageable and reusable. So right now, the community is waiting on the Landmarks Commission. They are doing their own independent analysis, having an engineer go through the facade, through the roof, looking at all the structurals, and having a cost analysis also done to see whether or not the hardship would be granted. And this sets a dangerous precedent for us, because this would literally be the first case where a steward, an owner of a landmark, in this case the congregation of West Park Presbyterian, failed to make repairs and basically ignored their responsibility, and then will then in turn be rewarded and relieved of their responsibility. And that's not how landmarks are supposed to work. They are the current stewards, and if they don't want it, it should go to another entity that could take care of it. It belongs to society, not just them. Mm-hmm. But this is the model of, you know, I have a pet dog, I no longer want the dog, so I will euthanize it rather than putting it up for adoption.
Yeah. Yeah. Sean Corsandi is my guest, the executive director of Landmark West, and we're talking about things Upper West Side, a lot of information. A lot of issues around the Upper West Side. Sean, we just talked about, you mentioned the Landmarks Preservation Commission, and so I want to kind of fold in the discussion, what you just said, to the Adams administration and the city of Yes. Are there any connections there? What do we need to be looking at in terms of the mayor and his position on any of this, and does it even factor in?
Well, I think everything factors in indirectly. Mm-hmm. So we are big proponents of the Landmarks Commission. We want landmarks. We want landmarks overseen and cared for. The Adams administration did cut the budget 3.5% this year for the Landmarks Commission, which is, I believe, the smallest staffed agency within his purview. And then, as you know, with the migrant crisis growing, there was an additional 4% cut. I think libraries got some of that money back, but the Landmarks Commission did not. So ultimately, that resulted in the loss of two staff positions. as that happened, there are increasing issues. We have had a flood of violations reported to us, and as a result, we've been reporting those to the Landmarks Commission, and they've added additional staffing to violations. They've also added additional staffing in response to vulnerable buildings. As you may have heard, there's other buildings recently that have been compromised. There were some on Gansevoort at 14th Street that were removed and need to be rebuilt. There was a building on Gay Street that fell. There was a synagogue on the Lower East Side, and then the Marble Collegiate Church just had its facade taken down. So part of this is hand in hand. The City of Yes wants development. So when they're approving larger constructions adjacent, more units of housing created, and allowing maybe more aggressive, let's say, adaptations and interventions into existing landmarks, you're compromising century-old foundations. You're upsetting party walls that have been stasis or leaning on one another for support. And as a result, some of the buildings themselves are being harmed. We're all for housing. We understand that. We understand there's an affordability crisis. But at the same point, the Upper West Side is the second densest residential neighborhood in America. So for a developer to come in and say, I'm going to take this church that has been here for 14 decades and had a tax-free existence, and I'm going to make luxury market rate apartments here, doesn't sit right with the community.
I certainly can well imagine that. And just one more thing while we're here talking about landmarking. What about other buildings in the Upper West Side that are in need, shall I say, of landmark status? Could you talk a little bit about the other buildings?
Sure, and there's a range. The Upper West Side is a diverse community. While you see tons of different neighborhoods, maybe the Upper East Side is more divided to different sub-neighborhoods, the Upper West Side is really one big swath from 59th to 110. Typically, the West End began at 72nd Street and moved north. Below that was an area called Lincoln Square. And there's a neighborhood, or the vestige of a neighborhood within that, called San Juan Hill, which was a little bit like the Tenderloin. It was largely lost to urban renewal, but there's a great suite of buildings there, Amsterdam Houses. It's part of the NYCHA complex. It's part of their portfolio. And it was one of the earlier projects. It's slated towards the river. It's using open space generously. It's human scaled. There's a lot of reasons why the collaboration between the architects in that case and the landscapers and the site integrate architecture of its time. We've been trying to push that towards the Landmarks Commission for attention, and so far we've been unsuccessful. Adjacent to that, part of the urban renewal is Lincoln Center, world-famous arts complex. That's state and national register eligible. We can't get that designated. On the flip side, we have smaller buildings. You might remember H&H Bagels, which the Upper West Side is famous for.
Oh, yes.
246 West 80th Street. It's a building partly owned by the Zabars, partly owned by the Friedland Properties. And it was once home to the Office for Metropolitan History, which is a research outfit that does lots of building research across the city and document recovery. That building was once home to the Parsons School of Design. This is where they were when the Parsons Table was designed. It was subsequently a communist school and had a million lives. They were built as artist studios. And right now there's an issue between the co-owners, where the Friedlands want to redevelop the site and the Zabars want to keep it because Broadway should be a mixed-use area. They want to keep the scale of the buildings. They want to support small businesses, canine style, a small bespoke store for clothing, fine clothing for your dog, had been there for decades. It's just moving out. There's a lot of other tenants that have been decanted over the years as the Friedlands plan to redevelop the site, but the Zabars never intended to lose the building. So this is a building that is worthy of designation, has the history behind it. The cornice is intact. The bricks are intact. It could use a good cleaning like many other buildings. And the Landmarks Commission declined, saying that it would be a great building for historic district, but it's not a standalone landmark. So as the landmarking discussion evolves, the Upper West Side, we are very lucky. There are tons of landmarks on the Upper West Side. Partly that's because of the way it was developed, the time it was developed, the architectural styles used, the cacophony of different building materials, and there's so many distinct zones within it that are indicative of New York. And I think that's partly why so many people flock here. They want to live here. But it's also you can't kill the golden goose. You can't just say, we love it, we've got these great assets, and let's overdevelop it. So it's always a balance.
Well, all right. Sean Corsandi, thank you for that. We've been talking about landmarks preservation for a bit. Let's talk about the equity in Public Design Commission, particularly let's get into Riverside Park. You oversee your organization, Landmarks West, 10 historic districts under your watchful eyes. So let's talk about, for a bit, the equity in public design, Riverside Park.
Sure. So you mentioned our historic districts. I mentioned before we have about 60 individual landmarks. There are also three scenic landmarks. So Central Park is within our bounds, as is Verde Square, as is Riverside Park. And this is another Olmsted Park. And so we oversee projects that either go before the Landmarks Commission, the Public Design Commission. We review permits and applications that affect the built fabric of our district. So one recently came through the community board, and it was about a guardrail in Riverside Park. And the initial plan was to do a simple black pipe rail, which is utilitarian. And of course, safety matters. Nobody's saying, let's have an unsafe condition. You don't go to a park to get hurt. But we've just seen a lot of these details. There was a beautiful revamp and renovation of the rotunda at 79th Street. And the Parks Commission is working to recreate foliate brass handrails. They're decorative. They swirl. They're the original design. The original drawings are gorgeous. And they're recasting them. They're replacing them throughout that entire complex. There are other stairs that had these details at 105th, 110th Street, elsewhere. And when the proposal came up for 105th Street, the Parks Department was looking to put in the simple pipe rail. And the pipe rail was used along the edge of the park. It was never used in the park. So they'd be introducing an inferior material, an inferior design, and something that was not native to Riverside Park itself. So we advocated that the guardrails that were originally there should be removed. And there were discussions, oh, these were stolen before. Whether they were stolen, whether they were removed, there's a range of people on the Upper West Side, and everybody deserves good design. And so if it's a scenic landmark, we should be vying for that gold standard. We should be doing what we know is right, not introducing something that is lesser. And the argument was that it's too expensive. Well, when the Landmarks Commission reviews a project, they're not supposed to consider cost, because in theory, this is in perpetuity. However, with scenic landmarks, there are no rules. So when an item comes before the Landmarks Commission, it only gets a binding report from the Landmarks Commission if it's a building, if it's a structure, if it's a bridge, if it's a rustic structure, if it's a portico or carport type of thing. That all goes to the Public Design Commission. So both different groups, the Landmarks Commission and the Public Design Commission, would review the project, but one would have an advisory and one would have a binding report. And this is part of a long-standing thing to sort of get out of another agency's way. Well, the Landmarks Commission reviewed this guardrail, and they said emphatically that this does not match the original design and that the original historic, ornate railing, guardrail in this case, should be returned. However, fast forward, this was never brought before a public hearing. It was an obtuse way to even find that report, which we happily found through the portal. But it was going to the Public Design Commission on a consent agenda. So the commissioners there were not going to get a full presentation on it. It would be reviewed at staff level, and we felt this was important enough, because if we can afford the design for the people who live near 79th Street, why can't we afford the same level of design and the same detail when the same molds exist for the people at 105th Street, which, as a census tract, has a lower area median income? And so we've just put out testimony on that. It was supposed to be heard on Monday, and it was pulled, so it's going to be moved probably the September 18th agenda at the Public Design Commission. So I encourage everybody to tune in for that.
So the LPC, Landmarks Preservation Commission, had this advisory support, and it's been suggested that they put back the original. I just want to make sure I'm following you correctly.
Correct. The LPC was great in this instance, and they echoed our committee's sentiments, and they said it.
Let's talk for a bit about one of the things that has been on everyone's agenda, the city's agenda, community groups throughout the city, has been 5G. The proposals throughout the city, but we're speaking specifically today about the Upper West Side, about towers being placed within the Upper West Side. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Some discussion about the co-location sites and so on?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Link NYC started several years ago, and essentially the business model failed. They owe millions of dollars to the city, and they have not made good on it. So they found a way to salvage the company by making it not just wireless, but now 5G, where they can sell space on the public right-of-way, the sidewalks, to these other companies. And they say they need these towers to be at least 32 feet tall, because that helps them with the signal. We are literally in the city with the tallest buildings in the hemisphere. We could easily put these on rooftops. We can easily make agreements. But it's harder for, say, Verizon or T-Mobile or AT&T to make an agreement with different landlords, different building supers getting access. What CityBridge is looking to do is create a network on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And so these towers, which are wider and deeper than they are in any other city in America right now, would rise 32 feet tall. People have likened them to Q-tips. There's a white structure at the top with five bands. Mm-hmm. And the idea is those are just a storage unit. The lowest one would have a wireless transmitter, and those other areas are areas that you could co-op. So maybe Verizon takes one slot, T-Mobile, AT&T, et cetera, would have others. So they're not even fully rented. The idea is that this is creating a network no more than every 500 feet, and it will offer continuous 5G to the city. It's not necessarily for free. You can plug into the kiosks and use it, but this is really for the people you already buy your cell phone data from to have a presence. On the Upper West Side, we've mainly avoided these so far, largely because our council member, Gail Brewer, wrote a letter saying she doesn't want them here. That's not saying no to 5G. Instead, what we have are things that they call backpacks. So it's a co-location site where they put something that by Section 106 is not supposed to be more than 3 cubic feet, piggybacked on top of those Cobra Head lampposts, you know, not the fancy Bishop's Crook ones, but the utilitarian ones. And those make sense. It's existing infrastructure, there's already a pole there, it's providing another service to the city, and we fully support that. We're not anti-technology, we just don't need additional things cluttering up the sidewalk. We've had a long ongoing pandemic. There's a lot of battles for sidewalk space, for bikers, for package delivery people, for sidewalk cafes. We don't need to be giving over more space to a for-profit entity just to sell real estate to cell phone companies.
Indeed. Sean Corsandi again with Landmark West, the executive director of Landmark West, the committee to preserve the Upper West Side. And we are talking about the Upper West Side, and just for listeners who may be new to Living for the City over WBAI, we have covered community groups throughout this city. Today we are focusing on the Upper West Side, and there's a lot to talk about. And Sean, thank you so much for the time that you've given us and this detailed information that you're providing. I guess one thing, and I imagine this is going deep into the weeds here. I'm trying to understand it, and I hope you can help me make sense of this. The Certificate of Appropriateness Committee, talking about variance and window sizes and the way windows are placed and how they're placed and why they're placed in a specific building, speaking about 230 Riverside Drive. Can you help me understand that better
properly
outline it to our listeners?
Yeah. Absolutely. If you're going to make a change to your landmark as an owner, you have to apply to the Landmarks Commission for a Certificate of Appropriateness, a C of A. And 97 to 98% of these go through at staff level, so the public never sees them. Maybe you might see your neighbor doing some work. You can check the database, check their address, and you'll find the permit there that way. But if people are making changes that don't suit the landmark, don't follow the rules, or are variant, they have to go through a full commission review. So that's something that has already gone through the community board, in our case CB7. Then our group reviews it. So we have a committee made up of several board members, architects, enthusiasts, neighbors, and we have a methodology that we follow for best practices for landmarks. So in the case of 230 Riverside Drive, it was one apartment out of a multi-story building that was seeking to replace its original steel casement windows with 1-over-1 double-hung windows, which you see everywhere. That's fine, but does it suit the landmark itself? And the landmark original buildings were steel casement windows, which have a finer grain, they have different muntin details, there's a different operational system. So about 8-9% of the building still retains the original windows. And the question becomes, well, should this apartment get to shift? And, you know, at a point of 10,000 feet, you say, oh, you know, what's one more? But the answer is, it's one more. One more moving further from the architect's intent. So in that case, a lot of changes have happened before buildings were designated or put into a historic district because, mind you, you can't be a landmark until you're at least 30 years old, and a lot happens in the life of a building. Some of these buildings are closer to a century. So the question is, are we going to further erode the historic fabric, or are we going to say, pencils down, let's look at the situation, evaluate it, and make a master plan? And in the case of 230 Riverside Drive, the commission took no action, and the idea is hopefully the applicant can come back with something more sympathetic to the original architect's intent, and maybe this can become the standard moving forward. So the remaining 8-10% of the apartments that have the original can either follow this new method of repair and replacement or some hybrid design that uses the best of modern technology and energy efficiency while meeting some of the aesthetic value as well. Mm. So our C of A committee reviews every application on the Upper West Side that comes through, and we testify on each one every week.
Every week. All right. Well, again, a lot of information that you provided. What can listeners do? I ask this question of every person and every community group that comes on Living for the City. What can listeners do? How can they get involved? What do you need? You have a very small staff there. I'm sure you could use some volunteers to oversee these 10 historic districts. How can people become engaged in your neighborhood?
Sure. At the very least, everybody can go to our website, www.landmarkwest.org, and there's a pop-up if you want to sign up. Our email mailing list is free. And just take a drive through our website. Most of our issues are outlined there, or you can always just call or email us directly. We need people who are engaged, and we find that if you're active in your community, if you're interested in what's going on, developers also take notice of that and react accordingly. They're more likely to accommodate community interest, and it's worked for us for 37 years, and we're hoping it continues this way.
Okay. One more time with the best way for people to get in contact with you. One more time for us.
Just go straight to our website, www.landmarkwest.org, and there'll be a pop-up within the first 5 seconds, and you can just sign up with your email. You can opt out at any time.
All right. Sean Corsandi, Executive Director of Landmark West, the committee to preserve the Upper West Side. Thank you so much for being on Living for the City today. And please stay in contact with Jillian and myself, and so we can bring more information about what's going on in the Upper West Side to our listeners here on WBAI. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you.
Jimmy Heath, One for Juan. This is Living for the City over WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. We're listener-sponsored and commercially free. And yes, as the chief announcer of WBAI, you hear me saying this regularly, almost hourly, at the top of the broadcast. I'm away right now and be back in a couple of weeks. But this is what we have to do to continue to bring you the issues that we try to bring you. Not saying that we're perfect in all things. We are certainly not. Lord have mercy. If I were to go and talk about some of the things that we need to do much more of, that would take up quite a bit of time. But I'm asking those of you who listen to this broadcast, particularly, to the station generally, to make a contribution in support of what we're trying to do. What we've been doing since 1960. I haven't been here since 1960, but the station has been here since 1960 in the center of the FM dial in New York City. Now, we have the website, WBAI.org, and you can go to that website, make a contribution there on the website, or call our pledge line that is available 24 hours a day at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And I so appreciate working with Jillian Jonas for these years. It's been since, I think, 2014. Right after, actually maybe a year or so after Superstorm Sandy, when we were displaced from 120 Wall Street, that and the, how much was that rent? $50,000 a month. Can you believe that? $50,000. How did we get trapped into that? $50,000 a month. This a commercial-free entity like this. Well, that's something for maybe the local station board to ponder, or others to ponder, along with a $30,000 a month rent at the Empire State Building. Again, something else for some others to ponder, but it's out there. And the general manager, Bertold Reimer, said to tell the truth. And that's what I'm trying to do here. Tell the truth. Because this radio station is too important, I believe, to let go by the wayside. So do what you can in support of WBAI. WBAI's Living for the City in particular, and I'm your host, Michael G. Haskins. I'm going to switch now, something that I started a little while ago, a couple of months ago, a TikTok corner. I know many of you, or some of you, some friends of mine have been critical of TikTok, but you know what? I think it's an additional way that we can bring some information to one another. And certainly, young folks and not so young folks are looking at and participating in being involved in this TikTok. So we're going to go to one or two of those, and then I have a poem I want to share with you. And when I get back, I'm going to bring in Raymond Nat Turner. He has an incredible piece that we're not able to get to today, but in a subsequent program, we're going to bring Raymond Nat Turner on to talk about Alabama. So let's go to our TikTok corner now, Michael G's TikTok corner here on Living for the City of WBAI.
Thank you.
I think we're going to try to play a little of Black Joy now instead of the TikTok corner with the error on my part. So we're going to go to Black Joy now before we run completely out of time here. We had a few minutes left, so let's go to Black Joy.
Black Joy. Is the will. It's the dimple that has endured, a dance so deep in a dark cheek, a wound without a scar, without a trace, the humor of hurt. It's the hell of being healed. Joy daps death, lives in the grin singing from the blood bays, and a smirk testifies tenderness in a tear. It is a smile silhouetted against the face, witnessing the want. The flower in the grenade, a rose in the concrete, a pirouette beside a barricade. It's the butterfly in the battlefield. It's disarming. The swing set in the middle of a gunfight. It's dodging a bullet, hopscotch, double dutch, a fierce gaze, the side eye, the shade, the sash, the snap, the head nod. It's the turn up, the swag. Joy is righteous and ratchet. Joy twerks and taps, jukes and jives, Harlem shakes, electric slides, dutty wine, salsas on twos and rumbas. Joy is rhythm and repetition. Rhythm and repetition. Hums in harmony is the blues, is a song in a cotton field or central bookings on a crowded subway. Joy is a song anywhere. Joy bees in the trap. Is a Dilla beat in the Middle East, is fly, is finger licking good, is pasteles with black beans or patty and cocoa bread. Is fried chicken with barbecue sauce or buffalo sauce or hot sauce or any damn sauce. Joy. Is a recipe passed on, a language that survives, savory, sweet, toe curling, knocking boots, the fight, the fury, making love to make up, it's the glow. It's an entire day in a lover's arms, a carton of ice cream and a bed of books, it's illuminated in the aftermath, wrinkled lips, a powdered kiss, the shivering hips, the theater of our thunder, joy. Joy is a story traveling. A rocking chair on the front lawn, a wind chime in a window, it's a barbecue in the backyard, subwoofers in a hoopty, it's melanin gathered in a room. It's the entourage, it's getting your friends in the club. Joy, joy, it's all about vibes. It's a roof over your head, it's clothes on your back, it's free 99, it's having the rent when it's due or having no rent at all. It's no debt, no credit check, joy. It's shooting dice in a stairway, it's getting a hand in spades, or a double six copy going dominoes, it's hoops in a crate, it's opening a fire hydrant in the heat. Joy is a six block willy through traffic with no handlebars in the rain. It's the catwalk. It's the voguing. It's the coming out. It's a crackhead with a dime bag and a dream. It's a fresh pair of white kicks with a check. It's bottle caps glued beneath dress shoes. It's $3 in the tank. It's catching rainwater in a tin cup. A firefly in your palm. Buying sunflowers for yourself on a cloudy day. It's a moon in the sky as if in a school play. It's your father in the audience.
joy of skipping school or recess.
Well, I didn't learn in school that they branded the slaves for identification purposes. Didn't know that because slaves were property, slave owners would like buy insurance so that like if they killed them, they wouldn't lose that much money. More notably, however, the companies that sold those policies the most and got bank from slaves are still around today and thriving. Like Aetna, the place that I get my school health insurance. Didn't know the dentures that George Washington wore were not only like animal teeth, but also enslaved people's teeth. Didn't know a lot of women and girls were basically just sex slaves. They force-fed them to fatten them up and then dyed their hair black so they would look younger. There were forced amputations, like cutting off an enslaved person's leg if they tried to run away. There was leather made out of enslaved people's skin, so like shoes, couches, stuff like that. And other bodily remains were put to use too, like fat and bones to make things like soap. Unlike Florida's new standard that says that slavery went on for so long and we have so many enslaved people here because of natural reproduction, there were actually breeding farms. So it was forced. It wasn't like a natural choice. We're talking back-to-back pregnancies and conception in a way that was not consensual. Get what I mean? And best for last, there are hundreds of politicians currently in office right now that descended from slave owners, the majority of whom are Republicans and or anti-reparations. Shocker. Including Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, and Marsha Blackburn. The more you know.
Joy is waving down the ice cream truck. A fresh lineup and a clean doobie, perfect coil to a curl or a loosened nap in an afro pick. It's the gift of gab. It's rapping your ass off. Roasting or wrestling a sibling to tap out. Joy is your mama jokes. Until it's your mama. The first foot out the jail, the homecoming, the graduation, the step show at the probate. Joy, joy, joy is hugging the self. It's what conquers the heart and captures the blame. It's the madness of our meaning. It's the maturity of our memory. It's the irony of our forgetting. It's a helicopter 4 days after the hurricane on a roof with no water or food. It's a mother picking her daughter up from foster care. It's smoking a joint in a cop car switching lanes. It's food stamps on the first of the month. It's no snitching. No snitching. It's loyalty. Perseverance, protest, resilience, resistance, the food after the funeral or the parade, the blessing, the curse, the call, the response, the prayer, the pulpit, it's evidence of things unseen. It's the hallelujah, the amen, the Holy Ghost speaking in tongues. When the Santo say you don't need no cleaning. It's genetic heirloom, it's the portable promised land, it's the diaspora. It is the diaspora. It is the diaspora making it overseas or making it over the Mason-Dixon line. Joy. Joy is family. It's brotherhood, it's sisterhood, it's feeling another's dimple in your face. It's together. Joy is together. It's together, unified on the front lines. Our joy will astonish the world. Because true joy has always been and will always be justice.
Black Joy by Aja Monet in collaboration with the TikTok Corner. I like that. I like how that played out, Black Joy and the TikTok Corner. And that's going to just about bring Living for the City to a close. Look forward, and please do look forward to next week's program. It's going to be very, very interesting, so please stay tuned for that. Again, this is WBAI's Living for the City. And before I go and say farewell, I want to encourage you one more time to make a contribution in support of this station, the entirety of this station, not solely Living for the City, but WBAI, the access to information like this without commercial interruption. So make your calls right now, your calls of financial support to WBAI. I'll see you in a couple of weeks, but do stay tuned for the upcoming programs, and hopefully your pledges of support will be coming through as well. Thank you so much for listening, and certainly thanks to Sean Corsandi, the executive director of Landmark West. Landmark West, the committee to preserve the Upper West Side. Thank you. Remember to surround yourself with people who respect and treat you well. We'll see you next time.
Do it for me.
What about me? What about me?
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The death toll in Maui has risen to 106 as officials began identifying the dead. Officials are still asking for people to provide DNA samples to help identify remains of those burned. The main road into Lahaina was opened last night, allowing residents to return to their homes. The State Department of Health is urging caution for those returning, warning ash may contain toxic and cancer-causing chemicals, including asbestos, arsenic, and lead and exposed electrical wires. Reports that land speculators are already seeking to purchase property have sparked action by Maui Governor Josh Green.
So I've actually reached out to our Attorney General to explore options to do a moratorium on any sales of properties that have been damaged or destroyed. Moreover, I would caution people that it's going to be a very long time before any growth or housing can be built. And so you will be pretty poorly informed if you try to steal land from our people and then build here.
Meanwhile, a Lahaina resident has shared video he took indicating the wildfire was sparked by a faulty power line.
Oh, this is live right across the street from my house. Freaking power line just went down. Started from up the road there. And all of that is still burning.
Shane True shared three videos on social media.
I hear a pop coming from across the street. As soon as I hear the pop, all I heard is like electrical, like this is going on the ground there. Look, there's a power line right there.
They were posted minutes after authorities say they received the first report of fire. Hawaii Electric Company faces criticism for not shutting off the power amidst high wind warnings and keeping it on even as dozens of poles began to topple. A class action lawsuit has already been filed seeking to hold the company responsible. Its president and CEO, Sheila Kimura, noted at a news conference Monday, many factors go into that decision, including the impacts on people who rely on specialized medical equipment and firefighters who need power to pump water. Donald Trump and his supporters are pushing back after a Georgia district attorney filed a 41-count indictment against him and 18 of his allies for their alleged role in attempting to subvert the 2020 election results in Fulton County, Georgia. Trump called it a witch hunt as he seeks to reclaim the White House for the Republican Party. His campaign this morning shared a poll citing 60% of Republicans are supporting him, rejecting any notion the fourth indictment is having an impact on the party's preference. David Weinstein, a former federal prosecutor, says it's an ambitious goal for Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis.
I think it's ambitious for the prosecutor to think that a 19 co-defendant case is going to go to trial within the next 6 months. We haven't seen yet the volumes of evidence that she's going to have to provide to all of these people. interlocking statements that are made by certain of the co-defendants.
Trump's campaign released a new ad of Trump attacking President Joe Biden, who's running for re-election. Trump goes after the Biden family for receiving some $20 million from foreign companies and business interests, while ignoring the wealth his own family has received, including the $2 billion Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, received from Saudi Arabia alone. As the Taliban celebrates the anniversary of its two-year rule of Afghanistan, the United Nations Special Envoy of Global Education, Gordon Brown, blasted the Taliban's repression of women and girls.
The denial of education to Afghan girls and employment to Afghan women is gender